And tonight I've been charged with the task of discussing the genealogies of Jesus. And I would like to do so with the thought in mind of emphasizing the identity of Jesus Christ and, of course, glorifying Jesus Christ. You know, genealogies in the Bible, to the casual reader, seem to be uninteresting and unimportant. These long lists of ancestry are usually skimmed or skipped altogether. But the serious student of the Bible can see in the genealogies a very important message. They can see that these genealogies are not only important, but they are also very interesting, filled with interesting information that can help create within us a greater appreciation for the power of God, the wisdom of God, the providence of God, and certainly create within us faith in Jesus Christ as the Son of God and, of course, the Messiah of God. Genealogies have always played an important role throughout Israelite history. We can see at least five different roles that genealogies played in the lives of Israelites. They helped to establish rights to the land and inheritance. They also assisted in applying the principle of kinsman redemption. They played a role in taxation. They determined eligibility for the priesthood. And certainly, and most importantly, genealogies were important because they fostered messianic expectations and hopes. Now, God, of course, had given messianic promises throughout the Old Testament. Specifically here, we find in the words to Abraham in Genesis chapter 22 and verse 18 that God promised Abraham, "In thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed because thou hast obeyed my voice." God eventually would narrow the promise and narrow the scope of this promise to the family of David. We find in 2 Samuel 7 verses 12 through 13 that God said to David, "When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." Here we find that God promises David that there would be one who would come from his very body, and the Jews and, of course, the Israelites would emphasize genealogical records because they understood that the Messiah was going to come from a very specific bloodline. In fact, in Matthew chapter 22 and verse 42, when Jesus asked the Pharisees, "What do you think of the Christ? Whose son is he?" They replied, "The son of David." So based upon such promises, the Jews anticipated the Messiah to be born in the family of David. And thus, in keeping and preserving genealogies, the records became extremely important among the Jewish people. The genealogy of Jesus Christ, as we find it recorded within the Gospels, really is found in two places only. Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 through 16. Luke chapter 3, verses 23 through 38. And we see that the pedigree of Jesus Christ is traced, and there are some similarities, but what is most controversial is, of course, the differences between them. Now, Matthew, the placement of these genealogies is very distinct. Matthew places the genealogy of Jesus before his birth, as you might would expect. But Luke places it before the ministry of Jesus, just as in the case of Moses, his genealogy is recorded before his public appearance before Pharaoh. We find that the genealogies begin somewhat differently. Matthew says, "The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham." Luke says, now Jesus himself began his ministry at about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, the son of Heli. So Matthew and Luke are much different from each other. We see that Matthew begins with Abraham, and he goes all the way down, forward to Christ, from Abraham to Christ, from father to son, 42 generations. And Matthew was writing to a Jewish audience, and his emphasis would be upon Abraham because of that. Luke, however, begins much differently. Luke begins with Jesus, and he goes all the way back to Adam, from son to father, 77 generations. Matthew begins much differently than Luke. Matthew is organized much differently than Luke. Matthew, perhaps as a memorization device, divides his genealogy into three sets of 14 generations each, omitting certain names and counting David twice. Luke, however, gives a more exhaustive listing. Matthew references five different women who are connected to prominent men in the genealogy, while Luke does not mention a single woman, not even Mary. Abraham, from Abraham to David, Matthew and Luke are the same. You'll read their genealogy and you'll see that from Abraham to David, they list the same names. But from David to Joseph, they are different. Matthew traces the line through David's son Solomon and the kings of Judah, while Luke traces the line through David's son Nathan, who is, of course, no king, who is a non-ruling son. The two lists continue to be divergent all the way to Joseph, with one possible exception, Zerubbabel and his father Salathiel, who may actually refer to the same individuals. Matthew lists Joseph as the son of Jacob. Luke lists Joseph as the son of Heli. Now that's a problem, it seems, because this apparent discrepancy between Matthew and Luke has become the source of much disagreement and is often used by critics of the Bible to attack the veracity and the accuracy of the Bible account. Now, if, however, the two genealogies are incompatible and contradictory, they would have been exposed a long, long time ago by the earliest enemies of Christianity. But they were not. There was no such allegations made in the early days of inaccuracy and contradiction. If proof of contradiction existed, it would have been exposed, certainly, or would have been promoted by the enemies of Christianity, but it was not, because contradiction could not be shown. Even among respected scholars, though, who accept Matthew and Luke as credible, there is a disagreement on how best to harmonize the two accounts. And I, for the next 30 minutes, we will talk about the major views and how to reconcile if we understand and we believe that Matthew and Luke are inspired. How do we reconcile these two accounts? And there are two views I want to present. The first view number one, is the idea that both Matthew and Luke give Joseph's genealogy. They're giving the lineage of Joseph. And according to this view, Matthew gives the legal line of descent from David, listing the heir to the throne had it continued, while Luke gives the physical descent of David in the branch of the family to which Joseph belonged. The father of Joseph, according to Matthew, is Jacob, and according to Luke, is Heli. So here is the question. How can it be said that Joseph is the son of two different men? Well, the discrepancy is explained by the Jewish law of levirate marriage. And this law is found in the book of Deuteronomy, in chapter 25, verses 5 through 6, where the law of Moses explains and sets forth this principle. If brethren dwell together and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of the husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. So let me illustrate what this really is teaching. Now, if a man marries a woman and without having any children, something happens and he dies. She is not to marry outside of the family. She's not to marry a stranger. But rather, her dead husband's brother is to marry her. And they are to have a child. The first son that they have is actually going to be legally considered the son of the dead brother. Even though he begot the child, he is the son of the brother who is dead. So that his name would not be blotted out of Israel. And that's the principle, that's the idea of levirate marriage. And that is seen throughout the Old Testament, and it is also suggested in the days of Jesus, as we see in his conversation with the Sadducees. Now, Barclay, he writes about this, and he says, if a man died childless, his brother must, if free to do so, marry the widow and ensure the continuance of the line. When that happened, a son of such a marriage could be called the son of either the first or the second husband. It is suggested that Joseph's mother married twice. Joseph was in actual fact the son of Heli, the second husband, but he was in the eyes of the law the son of Jacob, the first husband who died. Now Eusebius, as Bart mentioned last night, Eusebius, the Roman historian, he writes of this, and he speaks of this in the reverse order. He says, when Heli died childless, his brother Jacob took his wife, and by her became father of Joseph in the third generation. According to nature, Joseph was his son, but according to law, the law, Heli's son. Now, an important question arises from this view, regardless of who we consider was the natural father, and that is, how could Jacob and Heli be brothers? Since the father of Jacob is Mathan, and the father of Heli is Mephat. You see, Mathan, who descended from David through Solomon, and the father of Heli is Mephat, who descends from David through Nathan. So you've got two family lines. And how could we find that Jacob and Heli are brothers if they come from two different lines? Well, this is explained. Now, some argue that the father of Heli and the father of Jacob, Mathan and Mephat, are actually the same person, just a misspelling or a mistake, a scribal error, or that it was simply referring to the same person. If that's the case, another levirate marriage is needed to explain how a different person, Eleazar and Levi, could be the father of Mephat or Mathan. This approach is not impossible, but less probable. In fact, this entire view is based largely upon unproven conjecture. The oldest and perhaps best answer to this question goes back to Julius Africanus, who Eusebius writes about and speaks about. And Julius Africanus was a second century historian. And he writes about Mathan and Mathat. And he claims that Mathan, of Solomon's line, marries a woman named Esther, who bears him Jacob. Now, because they have a son already, because Mathan dies already having a son, and we'll just make him die of natural causes this time, right? She is free to marry outside of the family. And because of that freedom, she marries a man named Mathat. Now, according to Eusebius, accordingly, Esther, by her second husband, bears a son named Heli. So Heli and Jacob are half-brothers, and they have the same mother, but they have different fathers. Jacob's father descends from David through Solomon, and Heli's father descends from David through Nathan. And that's how it is explained, if we're considering Matthew and Luke to be the genealogies of Joseph. And that is how Eusebius explains it, as he is referring to Julius Africanus. Now, here's a problem, though. Now, let me show you the words of Eusebius. It says, the wife in question, whose name is given as Esther, first married Mathan, the descendant of Solomon, and bore him Jacob. Then on the death of Mathan, the widow married Melchi, whose line went back to Nathan, and who belonged to the same tribe, though not to the same family, and by him had a son, Heli. Thus, though the families were different, we shall find that Jacob and Heli had the same mother. When Heli died childless, his brother Jacob took his wife and by her became father of Joseph in the third generation. So here is the problem. According to Eusebius, he refers to Africanus' work, and he says that Esther marries Melchi, not Mathat. And so we have here, according to this view, a skipping. He skips over two generations in this. He doesn't mention Mathat or Levi. And it's really unknown why he does this, because he mentions the third generation. And since he pinpoints the second husband of Esther as the corresponding third from the end, in Luke's genealogy, perhaps he mistakenly inserted Melchi in the place of Mathat, but no one really knows. But this explanation, regardless of how you understand this, is based upon much speculation and one that fails, I believe, to accomplish the real purpose of genealogy. The most critical problem with this view is that if both Matthew and Luke give Joseph's line, then neither connect Jesus to the physical bloodline of David, since Joseph was not the biological father of Jesus. Caldwell says a legal line apart from the genetic integrity would not fulfill the promise or the fulfillment of prophecy of Samuel regarding the seed of David who will come from your body. And that leads us to the second view. The second view then is that Matthew gives Joseph's line where Luke gives Mary's line. And Matthew's record as the genealogy of Joseph is seen here, giving Jesus the legal right to the throne of David through Solomon. And Luke's record as the genealogy of Mary, giving Jesus the physical right to the throne of David through Nathan. This approach sees Jacob as the physical father of Joseph, and Heli as the father of Mary and the father-in-law of Joseph. And that raises an important question. If that is the case, could it really be said by Luke that Joseph was the son of Heli, even though he was not the physical son of Levi, only the legal or the lawful son of Levi by marriage? Well, various scholars, and Fowler in particular, He mentions that there were at least five different ways that a person could be considered the son of another man. Through natural birth, of course. Also through general descent. He could be considered a son even if he was adopted. The levirate son situation, as we described. But then there was also the son-in-law, as is illustrated here in 1 Samuel 25, where Saul refers to David as his son, and even though we understand that to be a son-in-law. Now, Machan, who sees Joseph as the heir of Heli by his marriage to Mary, proposes a slight modification of this view. This view suggests that Heli died with no sons, making Mary his heiress, in accordance with the provisions of Numbers 27, 1 through 11, and 36, 1 through 12. Consequently, therefore, Joseph may be designated in the Lucan genealogy as the son of Mary's father, Heli. Some scholars, unnecessarily, I believe, use rabbinic tradition to suggest a connection between Heli and Mary. Some believe that the Talmud actually refers to Mary as the daughter of Heli, and that is inconclusive, and I think even unproven, because it doesn't specify Mary. It mentions a Miriam, and there's debate as to whether or not it's the same Mary that we're speaking of here. And therefore, it's, I think, an unnecessary argument to refer to the Talmud as a proof of Mary being the daughter of Heli. Others may have more information on that. But this view that Matthew gives Joseph's genealogy, Luke gives Mary's genealogy, I think is consistent with the perspectives that they wrote from. You'll see here that when you look at Matthew's account, that Matthew focuses on Joseph. And he writes from Joseph's perspective over and over again. He is the focus of the account. The angel addresses him. The angel warns Joseph to flee into Egypt and informs him about the death of Herod. However, Luke writes from Mary's perspective. The angel's announcement is to her, her visit to Elizabeth, her song of praise, her delivery of Jesus, her ponderings in her heart, her sacrifice in the temple. Simeon's address is to her, and her words to the boy Jesus in the temple. So Luke is writing from her perspective all along. It is not unreasonable then to apply Luke's genealogy to Mary. And somebody might say, well, why doesn't Luke mention Mary in the genealogy? And the absence of Mary's name in the genealogy, I don't believe, does any damage to this view. Godet agrees. He says, ancient sentiment did not comport with the mention of the mother as the genealogical link. So this practice is in accordance with the Israelite law that genealogies must be reckoned by father, not mother. In support of this view, Linsky points out, he says, how Luke could think of appending a genealogy of Joseph after saying that Jesus was only supposed to be a son of Joseph, that is, a physical son. Luke himself, having shown at length that this supposition was wrong and that Jesus was a physical son only of Mary, has yet to be made clear by those who find the genealogy of Joseph here. The case is entirely different in Matthew, for there Joseph's genealogy is given as the husband of Mary, of whom was born Christ, end quote. Now, why then would Luke focus on the line of Nathan and avoid the royal line of Solomon? Why would Luke give us the genealogy of Jesus and avoid the royal line of Solomon in favor of the less known line of a son of David named Nathan? Well, I believe the answer reveals a very marvelous solution to a genealogical dilemma brought on by God's curse upon the royal line of David. And I want to talk to you for a few minutes now about this curse. But before we do, I want to notice that when God spoke to David, as we already mentioned somewhat of God's promise that God was going to raise from the very loins of David, the seed of David, from his own body, the Messiah, that we find that God is going to give David some promises. And he's going to give him two unconditional promises. The first unconditional promise is that the Messiah would descend from his bloodline. In Psalm 132, verses 11 through 12, the Lord has sworn in truth to David, he will not turn from it. I will set upon your throne the fruit of your body. If your sons will keep my covenant and my testimony, which I shall teach them, their sons also shall sit upon your throne forever. Now, God's promise here to David that the Messiah would descend from his bloodline, and this is an unconditional promise. He will not turn from it. Notice, however, that the promise of the Messiah's physical descent is extended to David's children with conditions. David says to Solomon in 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 2 through 4, he says, I go the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and prove yourself a man, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his judgments, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do, and wherever you turn, that the Lord may fulfill his word that he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons heed to their way, to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul, he said, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. So again, the promise to David is unconditional, that he would have the Messiah come through his body. But the sons of David had to meet conditions. And that is important. Now, the second unconditional promise, we'll get back to this in a moment, I believe, is that the royal line of David would continue in perpetuity through Solomon. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 12 through 16, we find this promise to David. When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. Now, I believe that while these words have clear messianic implications, that God is speaking of David's son, Solomon, when he says, if he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him as I took it from Saul, whom I removed before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever. So God's promise here, promise to David's son, Solomon, is that he was going to give him a throne in perpetuity. In spite of being chastised for sin, the legal right to the throne of David will not be removed from Solomon's descendants as it was from Saul. Solomon's royal right will not be taken away by sin, but sin will prevent the Messiah from physically descending from Solomon's line. Now, unfortunately, of course, we know the history. Solomon and most of the kings who followed after him did not satisfy the conditions of the promise. 14 out of the 21 kings of the Davidic dynasty are considered evil and ultimately will lead to God's final rejection in the form of a curse. A curse upon one of the last kings of Judah named Jehoiachin. Jehoiachin or Jeconiah or Coniah. He is considered or given the name, all three of those names. And this curse is spelled out here. Let me go back. In Jeremiah. Okay, we had a little lag there. But in Jeremiah 22, verses 28 through 30, God says of Coniah or Jehoiachin, or Jehoiah or Jeconiah, is this man, Coniah, a despised, broken idol, a vessel in which is no pleasure? Why are they cast out, he and his descendants, and cast into a land which they do not know? O earth, 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 hear the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, write this man down as childless, a man who shall not prosper in his days, for none of his descendants shall prosper, sitting on the throne of David and ruling anymore in Judah. Now, this is a very important prophecy. This is a very important curse. After a short reign of about 3 months, Jehoiachin, or Coniah, receives this divine curse upon his royal line. No man of his seed shall prosper sitting upon the throne of David. The position of the king is taken from him and given to his uncle Zedekiah, who becomes the last king of Judah. And there is no sustainable evidence at all whatsoever that the curse of Jeconiah's house was ever lifted, as some would argue. The curse does not mean that Jeconiah would literally be childless, because in the very context we see that he has descendants, but rather that there would be none of his descendants that would sit upon the throne. Now, neither does it mean that his line would lose the legal claim to the throne. Now, the curse, of course, simply prohibits a biological descendant of Jeconiah from reigning. No man of his seed shall prosper sitting upon the throne of David. But herein lies the messianic dilemma. In Matthew's account, we have Jeconiah given in the genealogy of Jesus Christ. And that is a problem. Jeconiah is an ancestor of Jesus, in spite of the fact that God said that none of Jeconiah's seed will sit upon the throne in Judah. How could Jesus obtain the legal right through Solomon's line and thereby satisfy God's unconditional promise, and at the same time avoid the curse that God accompanies being physically, or that rather that accompanies being physically born into that line? Now, some people believe that Jesus avoids the curse because he rules from heaven and not in Judah, as the curse specifies. And that seems to be a compelling argument. However, the solution that proposes fails to take into account the curse of Jehoiakim, the father of Jehoiachin. And the curse of Jehoiakim, mentioned in Jeremiah 36, 29 through 30, does not limit the curse to a location. Now, others believe God reverses the curse of Jehoiachin in the days of Zerubbabel. Now, this solution also falls short, for Judah receives no king after Zedekiah, only princes or governors. Zerubbabel is appointed governor and not a king of Judah. So the curse of Jeconiah is not lifted. And I don't believe there's any sustainable evidence to support that it was. But by giving Mary's genealogy, what we have here is Luke providing the most plausible and convincing solution to the curse. Instead of contradicting each other, the genealogies of Matthew and Luke show how God sends forth the Messiah from two lines. One, from which Jesus inherits the throne of David. The throne of David. But from which he could not receive the blood of David. Matthew's genealogy. The other line, from which Jesus receives the blood of David, but does not inherit the throne of David. And in this way, Jesus simultaneously avoids the curse of Jehoiachin, and fulfills God's promise to Solomon. Grimaki says, "The only way for Israel to have a rightful king apart from the divine curse was through the virgin birth. In this method, Jesus could receive the legal right, but avoid the physical curse because he was a physical descendant of David in Nathan's line." So Matthew gives the royal legal line. Luke gives the natural, literal, physical bloodline of Jesus through Mary. So the question surrounding the genealogies of Matthew and Luke are difficult. There's a lot more to it than what I have presented. There's a lot of different views and different explanations for the views that I have given, with more details, I should say. But the differences are not irreconcilable. They're not insurmountable. Kaufman summarizes it well. He says, "In the very nature of the God-man, it was inherent that two genealogies should be provided, one showing his legal status in the eyes of men, the other giving his true physical descent. The messianic title, the Son of David, as applied to Jesus, required a dual proof that he was entitled to the throne, as proved by Matthew's genealogy, and that he was literally descended from David, as proved by Luke's genealogy."